Luke 18, The Unrighteous Judge. The fourth talk in a series titled Reading the Book, Lessons in Understanding the Bible, was presented by Ron Julian on April 24, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're going to continue on in our series called Reading the Book. Tonight we're looking at the Gospel of Luke, chapter 18, the parable of the unjust judge. And bottom of the sheet I passed out last time, there was a little thing that you could have read and thought about if you wanted to. Basically presenting a not uncommon perspective that, after all, we have here a story that talks about someone who keeps bugging somebody else until they got what they wanted. So that must mean that the moral of this story is that we're supposed to, if we really want something from God, we're supposed to keep going back and asking until we get what it is that we've been asking for. And it's certainly not uncommon to hear this teaching. At one point, I was very interested in the question of why the Bible talks so much about prayer and what sort of a thing it is, and went and looked at a lot of different passages that talk about prayer, and also read some books by various Christian authors about what they thought prayer was. And one of the themes that showed up a lot in those books was the importance of, if you expect to get an answer from God, if you're looking for Him to do some particular thing for you, then you need to keep going back and asking and asking. One author said, when you pray, the answer is born at that moment, but it's on its way, and if you should stop praying, then it's going to fall short and not going to make it to you. And this passage is one of the ones that gets appealed to defend that. The idea is that we're supposed to continue to ask what we want until we get it. So I thought it would be interesting to look at this passage, partly because that's an interesting topic, prayer and what sort of a thing it's supposed to be. Also, I wanted for us to have at least one opportunity in this class to look at a parable, because obviously as students of the New Testament we're very interested in what Jesus had to say, and one of the things that he did a fair amount was that he taught in parables. So I thought it would be good for us to have an opportunity to think a little bit about what sort of a thing a parable is and how you go about understanding the point. Let me read the passage that we're concerned with. We've got eight verses here in Luke 18. Now he was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart, saying, "There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God and did not respect man. And there was a widow in that city, and she kept coming to him, saying, 'Give me legal protection from my opponent.' And for a while he was unwilling. But afterward he said to himself, 'Even though I do not fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will give her legal protection, lest by continually coming she wear me out.' And the Lord said, 'Hear what the unrighteous judge said. Now shall not God bring about justice for his elect, who cry to him day and night, and will he delay long over them? I tell you that he will bring about justice for them speedily. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?'" Okay. We need to start by just talking for just a minute about the parables and the sort of problem they represent when we come to read them. I think it's sort of helpful to think of the parables a little bit like being riddles. Because actually, in these stories, Jesus very often does not make it very explicit why he says what he says. What's the point of this story? Some of the parables that he tells, he just tells the story, and we have no comment from him at all as to why he told the story. Sometimes, as we do in this case, we have a little comment afterwards where he, after telling the story, says a little bit about it. But we know that these stories were somewhat cryptic and difficult to understand because that's the way the people at the time responded to them. In fact, at one point, his disciples come to him and say, "Why are you teaching everybody in these stories?" And in essence, what they're asking him is, why don't you just say what you mean? Instead of telling a story where everybody has to sit and think, now, what was the point of that? What was he getting at there? Why don't you just tell him? Why don't you, if you've got a theological point to make, why don't you just say it instead of telling these stories? And Jesus goes on to tell them, talk a little bit about why it is that he does that. It was such a characteristic of his teaching to teach in this way that towards the end of his ministry on earth, if you remember, he met with his disciples in the upper room on the night that he was betrayed, and he taught them a number of things. And at one point, the disciples say, "Whoa, you're talking to us directly and not using a figure of speech." And it's like it was so striking to them that he was actually just saying directly what his point was that they commented on it. "This is amazing. You're just telling us what you mean. Instead of telling us a story and we have to kind of sit back and figure out, now, what was that all about? You just told us the point. Wow, this is great." So Jesus' stories were cryptic, were meant to be cryptic, and in order to figure out what it is he's doing with the stories, you have to stop and think about what's going on with them. Now, we could have a whole class on parables, because there are a lot of them, and there's a lot to say about what the parables are and how to approach them. But I just want to make a really brief comment about what I think the parables are before we actually look at this particular story itself. Because there are kind of two ways you can go in thinking about the parables. One direction you can take is to think of the parables as a kind of a code. There's this coded message, and I have to decode it in order to figure out what it is that Jesus is saying. So in this sort of approach, the key is to take each element in the story and figure out what does it represent. Okay, we've got birds, and we've got oil, and we've got X, Y, and Z. Now I need to take each of those and figure out, what is the code? What do those things represent? That's one approach that people take towards the parables. I would argue, I'm not going to really argue the case tonight, but I'd be glad to talk to you about it if you want, that the parables are not like that. They are not like coded messages where I have to figure out what each one of the things stand for. Even though sometimes it is helpful to make certain connections, the parables instead are more like what we might call analogies. Jesus is saying, okay, there's this thing that I want you to understand, and I'm going to explain it to you by painting a picture, by telling a story that is like something that you understand already. And when you have understood this situation, then I'm going to draw certain parallels and make certain comparisons between what you understand in this story and the reality that I'm talking about. So the simplest kind of example of that is the sort of story he would tell where, for instance, he's talking to the Pharisees and he tells them a story about a vineyard owner who has some people who are caring for his vineyard, but then when he sends his servants to get the results, the produce from the vineyard, the people who are taking care of the vineyard kill the servants and kick them out, and they won't give the owner of the vineyard what it is he deserves as the owner of the vineyard. Finally, he says, I'll send my son. They'll listen to him. They kill the son and say, look, now we'll just keep the vineyard for ourselves. And then Jesus asks the question, so what do you think the vineyard owner ought to do in that situation? And the Pharisees say, boy, he ought to get in there and kick those guys out of that vineyard. I mean, that's his vineyard and they're messing up, so he ought to go in there and kick them out and kill them and get rid of them and put somebody in there that can take care of this for him right. And Jesus says, that's right. That's what he ought to do. And the funny thing is, I'm talking about you. The parallel that he's drawing is the rejection of the prophets and then finally the Son of God by the religious leaders in Israel, particularly the Pharisees that he's talking to, who were not accepting him as the Messiah. So, you see, in that example, they look at the story, they understand it. They understand the ingratitude and the injustice of treating the servants and the son of the owner of the vineyard in that way. It makes sense to them. They understand the story. Then Jesus makes the connection and says, I'm using this as a picture of what you have done. And naturally, at that point, they were not happy with what it was he was saying. That's the sort of thing that a parable is. There's something about the story that makes sense. So what we need to do when we start to try to understand what's going on in a parable is, first of all, we need to look at the story and try to understand what's happening. There's something in the story that makes a certain amount of sense. And we're trying to find that thing. And then we're asking the question, how does that relate to the reality that Jesus is talking about? Because he's not really concerned with widows and judges in the story that he's telling here. He's telling it because it helps to make a point that he wants to make about something else. So, in what I've passed out to you, I have tried to very simply divide this section up for you. It's not hard to do. You can see what it is I'm doing here. We start out in the first verse. Luke makes a comment. Now, he was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart. That's a comment by Luke. This is why Jesus did what he's about to do. He said this, and this is why he said it. Then we have the story itself told by Jesus. There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God and did not respect man. And there was a widow in that city, and she kept coming to him, saying, give me legal protection from my opponent. And for a while he was unwilling, but afterward he said to himself, even though I do not fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will give her legal protection, lest by continually coming she wear me out. That's the story. That's the little fictitious story that Jesus has put together to be some sort of analogy or comparison to the real issue that he wants to talk about. Now, as I said, with many of the parables, it would stop right there. He would never actually go on to say any more about why he told the story. He just tells the story, and you're left to figure out what is the reality that he's talking about, and what is the connection between that and the story? In this case, we have some further comments, which may explain the story, or it may jump off from the story and make another point. We can't necessarily assume that in the comments that follows that he's going to explain what it is he just did. Sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. But what he says is, hear what the unrighteous judge said. Now shall not God bring about justice for his elect, who cry to him day and night, and will he delay long over them? I tell you that he will bring about justice for them speedily. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? Okay, now, hopefully you can see the difference there. In the story, we have a story. It's a fictional story about a widow and a judge. In his comments, he has stepped out of the story, making comments about the story to connect it to the topic that he wants to talk about. And now he's saying things about God and about what God is going to do and about the coming of the Son of Man. These are not fictitious things that he has made up. These are the realities that he wants to talk about. God coming to bring justice and not delaying, and the Son of Man coming, will he find faith on the earth? Those are the realities. Those are the things that he has on his mind. The story has something to do with those things. So our job as readers here is to try to figure out what is it that's happening in the story and what is the connection with that and the point that he's trying to make. As students, as interpreters who are trying to figure out what's going on, sometimes it's hard to know exactly where to jump in. We have three different parts here. We have Luke's comment, the story itself, and Jesus' comments. Each of them, in the end, when we're done, we want to understand each of the pieces so that they all fit together, so that they all make sense together. But sometimes starting at the beginning will be the best thing to do. Sometimes you jump to the end and see if you can figure out, you know, look at the end, see who did it, so that you can figure out all that stuff that was happening in the middle. It's hard to say. I can't recommend to you and say, here's the line that you should follow. If you do this, it will always work. You kind of have to just jump in and thrash around and see what makes sense. Let me point out some things, I think, that help us move along towards understanding what Jesus is saying. Luke's comment, he gives us the reason why Jesus told the parable. He wants to show them something. He wants to convince them that something is true, and in particular that they ought to do something. And the thing that they ought to do is, at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart. That's what he's trying to show them. That at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart. So the first thing that's helpful to notice is the connection between those two things. He's saying they ought to pray at all times and they ought not lose heart. They ought not despair. And somehow here Luke is saying that there's a connection in what Jesus is saying here between this continuing to pray and not losing heart. Presumably, if I lose heart, then I won't be praying anymore. And conversely, if I don't lose heart, I continue to pray. Now, we don't know exactly yet what that connection is or how he's putting that together. But seemingly, the idea here is some sort of connection between continuing to pray and not losing heart. So let's see if we can make some sense out of that then. We go to the story that Jesus tells. It's helpful to know when we come to a story like this, we're not living in the same cultural situation that they were. It's helpful to understand that a widow in this culture would have been in a position of relative weakness. In the culture that Jesus is speaking into, a woman's position in society was largely determined by her husband. Her husband's property, her husband's place in society. If there were legal problems, if there were an enemy that needed to be dealt with, it was the husband's place in that society that would have been her best protection. I think to a much stronger degree than it is true in our culture today. Not that there couldn't be a certain amount of truth to that even still, but by and large, when we think of our justice system, at least in theory, is committed to the idea of the impartiality between people, and that a lawsuit with a man on one side and a woman on the other side, in theory, could go either way. And that's more or less true in our society compared to what we would find here. The widow in this situation is sort of helpless. She has an enemy. Presumably some injustice is being done her. And she keeps going to a certain judge here who is the only one that she's got. I'm going to go to him and I'm looking to him for justice. I'm looking for him to do right. If something has been taken from her, he wants the judge to step in and get it back from the person who took it, to exact retribution, to make that person stop doing what they're doing and to pay for whatever it is that they have done. Unfortunately, in this situation, she has a judge who does not fear God nor respect man. You understand, for the judge to fear God, that would mean he's looking at his actions and thinking, there is a God in heaven who has a standard of right and wrong, and I am going to be answerable someday before him for what I have done. So, although this widow may have very little standing in society, very little to contribute to me, I'm not going to get anything out of it if I give her the justice that she's asking for. Nonetheless, it would be the right thing to do. And so, I'm going to do it because I fear God. I'm concerned about doing what is right. I'm concerned about doing what God would want me to do. This judge doesn't care. He does not fear God. He has no interest in what, say, the law of Moses would have said about justice and so on. He's just, the question is, what's in it for me? And he does not respect man. There are several things that this might mean, but you can kind of get the picture of, I don't really care about the people that are in front of me either. I don't care about what their situation is. Again, I'm in it for myself. I don't fear God. I don't care about people. Sometimes we use the phrase no respecter of persons, and we mean we're impartial, and we give to each person what they deserve apart from any outward social things or something like that. That's not what it means here. This is like the opposite of that. It's like the fact that this is a widow who's in need of justice doesn't mean anything to me. Now, if she was to slip a nice fat bribe my way, now that would be something interesting to me. But I'm not interested in her. That's the kind of judge that she's going to. And so naturally enough, she goes to him seeking justice, and the answer she gets is no. Presumably, I think the implication in this story is that there really is right on her side. That if justice were being done, he would give her the justice that she's asking for. But he doesn't care, doesn't fear God, doesn't respect man, so forget it. What Jesus says is she kept coming to him. And for a while he was unwilling, but finally he says, look, I don't fear God or respect man. And you understand, this is just Jesus sort of spelling out for us clearly. What are his motives here? I'm not doing this because it's right. I'm not doing this because I care about this widow in front of me. But the fact is, if she keeps bugging me, I mean, she's back, and then she comes back again, and then she comes back again. This is really getting irritating. And if she keeps doing this, it's just going to make my life miserable. So I think what I'll do is I'll give her what she asked for. Get her out of my hair. Then I won't have to worry about it anymore. Now, I have a comment to make here. There is a complication having to do with Greek and stuff like that at this point of the story that I'm not going to bring into the discussion at this point. So I'm oversimplifying just a touch as in what I just said, but for the sake of making the point I want to make, I'm going to oversimplify. And if at the end anybody's interested in pursuing the complexities of it, I'll be happy to do that. But so I'm just warning you. I'm just telling you. I just wave my hands and quietly swept a problem under the rug that you didn't notice. I'm just trying to be honest in telling you I did that. And we can talk about that at the end if you want. But basically, I think what we've got here is the reason he decides to do it is I finally decided it's in my best interest. I mean, I don't want her to keep bugging me. This is just too much. All right. So what does this story tell us? I could think about it. Okay, the analogy that Jesus wants to make is that God is like this judge, that even though he may not at first want to give me what I ask for, if I keep bugging him about it long enough, eventually he'll get tired of me bugging him and he will give me what I ask for. That could be. I mean, logically speaking, right, that could be the analogy that he's making. The problem with that is that doesn't seem very probable somehow. I mean, this is the creator of the universe. This is the God who is sustaining all and knows all and is involved in all. Is it likely that I could like bug God? I could get God to the point where he gets tired of me asking him and says, oh, I'm tired of this. I mean, he can sustain the whole universe, but he can't handle me coming back every couple of days and saying, how about that Ferrari or whatever it is I'm looking for? I mean, it seems to me that someone with the strength, wisdom, power and understanding of God, if he needed to, could put up with me bugging him for 1,000 years. If he didn't want to do it, he's not going to do it. I mean, the thought makes no sense to me. So maybe Jesus is saying something that doesn't make any sense. Maybe he's making a nonsensical point. Or maybe he's not making this point, and there's another point in the story that is a little different. We know that Luke tells us that this is about praying at all times and not losing heart. And what we see in the story is a widow who keeps going back and finally got what she was asking for. So one of the things that is striking is Jesus is, according to Luke, confronting us with the choice. Are we going to continue to pray and not lose heart? Or are we going to despair? Are we going to lose heart and give up? Well, in this story, the widow, if we think about the situation, here's this widow, she goes back, she goes to the judge, she sees the kind of man she's dealing with, a man who does not fear God or respect men. He hears her case. He doesn't care about the merits of it. He just dismisses it. And she comes back again, and he doesn't care about the merits of it. He just dismisses it. There would come a point at which she might say to herself, why should I bother to go back? He doesn't care. She could have lost heart and not gone back. Well, in the story that he's telling, what would have happened to her if she had lost heart and not gone back? She wouldn't have gotten the justice that she finally got. In the story, she finally did get what she was asking for. And the reason she got it was because she kept going back. Now, it's true, she bugged him to death, I think, ultimately, but the fact is that if she had not kept going back, if she had given up and despaired, then she would not have gotten what she asked for. So the point that the story could be illustrating, and in fact I'm just going to say I think it is the point that the story is illustrating, is in her situation, even given the fact that she was dealing with an unjust judge, with a judge who did not care about justice, what was the right choice for her to make? What choice made the most sense? Was it to keep going back or to give up? Even with a judge who didn't care anything about what she was asking for, the right choice for her was to keep going back. Because who knows? Maybe he'll change his mind. If I don't go back, I know I don't have it. If I go back, maybe something will happen and I'll get it. And as it happens in the story, she does get it. Which brings me then to the comments that Jesus makes. The Lord said, "Hear what the unrighteous judge said." Well, what did the unrighteous judge say? He said, yes. I mean, in essence, what it boils down to is the judge who did not want to give her what she was asking for finally decided, he relented and said, well, I'm going to give it to her anyway. I would argue that what makes sense of Jesus' comments here when he says, "Hear what the unrighteous judge said, now shall not God bring about justice for his elect, who cry to him day and night, and will he delay long over them?" What he's doing is comparing in this story with a judge who did not care about what was right and did not care about the widow that was in front of him. The widow's right choice, the smart choice, still was to go back, because who knows, you might get the answer yes. And in fact, in the story, the way Jesus tells it, she did. Well, if it makes sense to go back to a judge who doesn't care about the justice that you're asking for, how much more sense does it make to keep going back to the judge who does? Because the God that we're dealing with is not like the unrighteous judge. And that's very much, I think, a part of the comparison that Jesus is making. Why does he go to such lengths to paint the judge as so indifferent to what was right? Because the God that we're dealing with is not like him at all. He is not at all indifferent to what is right. Is there anyone, any being in all of creation that has more of a concern for justice than God, the one who created it all? Is there anyone who cares more about justice? Do we have to go to God and somehow convince him, remind him, oh, come on, God, I know that you're not very interested and you're kind of bored with this whole thing, but justice, that would be a really good thing, don't you think? Couldn't we kind of convince you that maybe it would be a good idea to have a little justice now and then? No. We're dealing with the God whose character is where we learn about justice in the first place. I mean, this is the righteous judge. And notice how Jesus refers to him bringing about justice for his elect, his chosen ones, his people. This is a judge who doesn't care about the righteousness of God and doesn't care about the widow who's in front of him. But we are going to the God who cares about righteousness and who cares about us, his people. We are his people. So if it made sense for the widow to keep going back, then how much more does it make sense for us to keep going back? Now, there's another point of comparison, I think, a very important comparison that we need to pay attention to here. Why is it that Jesus needs to say a thing like this? Why does he need to urge us to continue to pray and not lose heart? I mean, if you can imagine, I'm making this up on the spot, but here you're standing in front of a gumball machine. You put in your money, hit the button, and the gumball instantly comes out. I don't say to you, now, after you've put in your money and hit the button, don't lose heart. Wait for that gumball, all of a tenth of a second that it takes for it to drop into the tray there. Don't get discouraged. Don't lose heart. Don't worry, it'll come. Why don't I say that? Because I don't need to. Who's going to lose heart over that? I mean, you punch the button, it's there. There's lots of stuff like that. I turn on the TV, it comes on. I mean, nobody has to encourage me not to lose heart about such things. I don't have to hang in there because it just happens. But there is a point of parallel between us and the widow in her dealings with the judge. The judge that she was dealing with did not care about what was right, did not care about her. But there is a similarity in her situation and ours when it comes to God. And that is, we ask God and we don't get what we're asking for. Just like the widow who goes back to the judge. She's seeking justice, she didn't get it. The fact is that at least a strong possibility here for part of the parallel, why he can tell a story like this, is although it is not true that God is evil and unconcerned with us, it is true that we find ourselves in the same situation that the widow did, having to make the same decision. God isn't paying off. It's not happening. Now, I want to call your attention to some things here that I think help us to focus in on what kind of thing Jesus is talking about. Because there are a lot of things that he could be talking about. I mean, I joked about praying for a Ferrari. Well, what about that? There are lots of things I might pray for and get the answer no, or at least it doesn't happen. I want to get that job and I pray and I didn't get it. I'm sick and I pray and I'm still sick. There's an example of seeming to get the answer no when I pray. So is that analogous to the situation that Jesus is talking about here? And he's saying, if you're sick, just keep praying and ultimately the answer will be yes and you'll be healed. If you want that job, keep praying and ultimately the answer will be yes and you'll get that job. Or does he have something else in mind? Well, let me point you to some indicators here that I think show us that he has a different kind of picture in mind. We are talking about asking God for something and facing the reality that we are not getting what we're asking for. But I think we can get more specific than that. Notice, in the story, the widow is asking for justice. Now, that could just be part of the analogy. I mean, she could have been asking for food, or she could have been asking for a place to live, or, you know, whatever. Does Jesus mean to take and just use that justice that she's asking for before the judge as an example of anything that you might ask for? Well, it's interesting that when he steps out of the story and talks about the reality, our calling out to God, he says, now shall not God bring about justice, bring about retribution, vindication for his elect who cry to him day and night. He's still talking about justice. He's picturing here the people of God calling out to God, his elect, calling out to him day and night for this thing. They've translated it justice here, but this word actually shows up a fair amount in the New Testament, and it's justice, it's retribution, vengeance is a way that it is translated sometimes. The idea of this word is I am appealing to a judge to deal with this unjust situation. Evil has prevailed, and those who are in the right are suffering. The appeal is that justice would be done, that those who are doing evil would be stopped, would have to face into the consequences of what they have done, and that the people that they are doing evil against would be delivered. Now, the interesting thing is that if we're going to talk about justice in that sense, retribution, vindication, those kind of concepts, when the Bible talks about God doing that sort of thing, the picture is fundamentally not of, hey, today, God, this guy ripped me off, so I want you to go over and mess up his house, or, you know, I want you to go and deal with him. Go break his legs, God. It doesn't work like that. I'm encouraged not to take vengeance into my own hands, and I'm told that, I mean, God says, using this word, vengeance is mine. I will repay. There's an interesting sort of parallel, I think, in the book of Revelation, where we see, and I'm not, that's a can of worms that I don't want to open up here at this point, but we can see in chapter 6, starting in verse 9, and when he broke the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And there was given to each of them a white robe, and they were told that they should rest for a little while longer, until the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed even as they had been should be completed also. Well, this is a striking picture. I mean, obviously, this is, it's a symbolic sort of picture, I mean, under the altar and all that sort of thing. But what we have is people who have been killed because of their being people of God, crying out to God saying, how long until you avenge, until you bring justice? It's the same word here that Jesus is using in this parable. How long is it going to be until you bring justice? And of course, the picture that you see in the book of Revelation is the answer to their cry is ultimately God comes, the day of the Lord comes, the Messiah comes, riding in on a white horse, you know, with the symbolic imagery and so on, and basically eliminates evil on the earth, vindicates his people, raises them up, delivers them from the evils of this world, and establishes his kingdom. It's a very, very common theme that the Messiah is going to be the one who comes to bring justice on the earth. And it's also a very common theme for the people of God in the Bible to be crying out. They were crying out in the Old Testament. We see them crying out in the New Testament. How long, O Lord? How long is it going to go on like this? When are you going to make it right? In those passages, the picture is of calling out to God to make things right, to bring about justice, and the answer that he provides is one day, I am going to step in and bring the justice that I have been promising. Meanwhile, you have to wait. Now notice in this passage, we have that same thing. His elect who cry to him day and night. Day and night, the chosen ones of God have been crying out to him for justice, for God to come and make things right. I tell you that he will bring about justice for them speedily. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? And that statement there, that last statement, I think, is the most important whole little passage. Because that really helps to cement what kind of picture Jesus is talking about. He didn't just go off on a total tangent to talk about something else. The Son of Man coming, why is he talking about that now? Well, he has just said that God is going to bring about justice for his elect. When is he going to do that? Do I have a promise that he's going to do it today? Am I going to wake up tomorrow and injustice will be gone? The people of God will find their place of security and blessing and the injustice of the world will have been done away with? No, probably not. But there is a day coming. It's when the Son of Man comes to fulfill his role of wiping out all opposition to God, all evil, all sin, all death, bringing it to an end and establishing God's kingdom. So, in essence, then, what Jesus' statement at the end is saying is, we can kind of wrap it up like this. Look, if an ungodly, unrighteous judge like this, it was appropriate to keep going back to him when the answer was no, when the widow didn't get what she was asking for, how much more sense, how much more essential is it that we keep going back to God, keep going back to the one who cares about justice, who cares about his people? I tell you, he is going to bring about justice speedily. We'll talk about that speedily in a second here. He's going to do it. But when the Son of Man comes, when I come back in fulfillment of those promises to bring about the justice that God had always promised he would bring about, will there be anyone left who is expecting me? Or will everyone have lost heart? Will everyone have given up? Nobody is left calling out to God anymore for him to bring justice because they've all given up. There's no faith left. Now, he's not saying that that's what's going to happen, but he's asking the question, when I come back, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? What I would argue is, when we look at the story and Jesus' comments, we see a different sort of picture. This is about hanging in there. This is about going back again and again when the answer seems to be no. But he is not saying, whatever it is I might think I want, if I keep going back over and over again, eventually the answer will be yes. He's talking about, in particular here, in a world where so much is wrong and unjust, to continue to seek from God the deliverance from that, to not give up, for me to continue to pray, for me to continue to go to God, is for me to continue to believe that he will do what he has promised. So the distinction that I'm trying to make here is that in this story, this is not whatever you want, if you keep asking and bug God, you'll get it, but rather something like justice, which God himself is committed to and has promised to bring about on the earth. Will I continue to go to him, continue to cry out to him to do that which he has promised, or will I stop? To stop praying in that regard, then, is in essence to stop having faith. That's why he can say, Luke can say at the beginning, he's telling them to pray at all times and not lose heart. And at the end, Jesus can put it, will he find faith on the earth? Praying at all times and not losing heart and having faith, they're the same thing. It's when I have given up. It's when I have lost heart. I don't see any point in crying out to God anymore because I don't think he's coming. I just don't think that it's a percentage move anymore. I got to find somebody who is going to do something a little more practical. And I've got to go hire myself a hitman or go bribe a judge somewhere or something because this God stuff just doesn't cut it. It is interesting that this section, they ought to pray at all times and not lose heart, does follow right after his statement in Luke 17, where he talks about the return of the Son of Man, his coming in glory ultimately. And then here he's telling them, I want you to keep praying and not lose heart. Keep praying is a way of saying, keep believing God's promises. Keep going back to Him. When the pressure is on and you have to go someplace, go to God. Just because the other times you went to Him, it seems as if the world still goes on the way it has, and the injustice is still there, and there's still so much to suffer through. Nonetheless, go back to Him. Keep going back to Him, because He's the one who's going to bring this stuff about, and He is going to do it. Now, I mentioned this word speedily. It seems kind of strange. And that there actually is some question, if we look at the Greek, as to whether speedily is the best translation. But let's just take it on its face value for now. If that was the way to translate it, could we make sense out of that? Considering it has been like 2,000 years since Jesus said this. Well, the passage that I find interesting in helping me sort out. Okay, and so now I do my showing you that I didn't grow up in Sunday school routine, where I try to find the book of Habakkuk in there we go. Minor prophets are always my downfall. I never find the minor prophets. In the book of Habakkuk, in chapter 2, we have this picture. Habakkuk is really concerned about Israel as a nation. He knows has been unfaithful to God, but God has responded by bringing judgment upon them through the Babylonians. The Babylonians are worse. So here's Habakkuk trying to figure out, God, what are you doing? You know, you're going to wipe out your people and you're going to exalt a people like the Babylonians? This doesn't make any sense. And so he's waiting to see, how is God going to respond? What's going to happen? What is God going to do ultimately? I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart, in chapter 2 of Habakkuk, and I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. Then the Lord answered me and said, record the vision and inscribe it on tablets, that the one who reads it may run. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward the goal, and it will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it will certainly come, it will not delay. And the thing that's interesting to me here is he's talking about there's this vision that he's going to give him, explaining what ultimately God is going to do, how this ultimately is going to work itself out. But what he says is, though it tarries, wait for it will certainly come, it will not delay. And it's that interesting sort of juxtaposition of ideas, that it's going to tarry, which basically means delay, but it will not delay. So I think it's not too hard to figure out what Habakkuk is being told there. It's a picture of, yes, you're going to have to wait. And actually, there was a lot of waiting. And ultimately, when we talk about God's entire purposes for the nation of Israel, they're still waiting. This was a long time ago, and we're still waiting to see the final outcome of it all. So in a sense, yes, it's going to tarry. And so you're going to have to wait. You're going to have to be patient. But it is coming. There's no question that it is coming. It will not delay. And I think the idea there of it's not delaying is, it's not as if God is sitting around trying to decide, well, maybe someday I'll help him out, or maybe I won't, I don't know. You know, I'm not feeling like it right now. Don't bug me right now. Maybe someday I'll do something about it. No. God has decided, He has determined, He is going to act, this is going to come about. And so there will be no delay. There's nothing keeping God from doing this. No hesitation on his part, nothing in his way. It is coming along and it will arrive right on time. There is nothing that will stop it. That kind of idea, I think. So, summing up here then, what I think is going on, we have a story, and in the story, we see a picture of a person who perseveres in seeking justice from a judge, even though he keeps saying no, and even though he himself is evil and unconcerned with justice. Jesus tells us this story in order to commend what she did. She hung in there. She kept going back. And so should you keep going back. Why? Because even though you too have to wait, as she had to wait for the ultimate answer, you're not dealing with an evil judge as she was. You're dealing with God, the righteous judge who cares about his people. He has promised that he will bring justice, and he will do it. So keep going back to him. Do not give up on him. The kind of perseverance in prayer that is being pictured in this parable then is not, if I want something and I keep bugging God long enough, I'll get it, but rather, if I continue to believe that God is going to do what he said he will do, then I will be among those who will be prepared when he finally does it. I'm going to keep asking him, I'm going to keep going back to him, because the day is going to come when he is going to do what he said he would do. It may be after I am dead, but it doesn't ultimately matter, because he's promised to bring me back. Ultimately, he is going to bring justice. I am going to live in a world where justice prevails, where evil has been vanquished, and so I'm going to keep turning to him. Every time injustice and suffering in this world comes my way, I'm going to take it to God. And of course, I'm hoping that he does something right now. And maybe sometimes he will. Maybe sometimes there will be relief at the moment. But you know, we all know, when we look at the people of God in the Bible, that sometimes the relief doesn't come. Sometimes you call out to God to be delivered, and instead you die. It can happen that way. And yet, that is not God reneging on his promises, because he is committed to do what he has promised to do. And therefore, I should keep going to him, even if it seems the answer is delayed and I'm not getting the relief that I need. I should keep going back to him because I know who he is. I know what he has committed himself to do. So there's no question. It's not a question of me wanting a job or wanting to be healed or something like that. This is me knowing that God has promised to do something, and so I continue to go to him knowing that he will keep the promises that he's made. Okay. I don't know if I hope that was clear. We can take a minute here if you want, and any questions or comments that you might have.
I'm sure you already beat this question to death, but why do you need to keep going back to him if you know that eventually justice will be done?
Right. Well, see, the picture that Jesus is painting here is he's giving this as an alternative to despair. I don't think that he's suggesting that I need to every day get up and pray to God, God, please bring justice. I mean, I can get up and feel confident that God is in charge and that ultimately things are going to turn out all right, and I can like go and do my job or, you know, whatever it is I have to do that day. He's not saying, make sure that you're constantly talking to God about this. But I think he's dealing with the realities of ourselves as human beings in dealing with God. When the pressure is on, when the pressure is on me personally, I usually don't just have the blasé sort of, well, I know it's going to turn out all right, so I'll just cruise along. I mean, I'm under the gun. And it's when I'm under the gun that the question is, where am I going to go? I mean, I might say, I don't want to have anything more to do with you. But instead, I cry out to him, help, I'm looking to you because I still trust you. That's the kind of thing I think he's saying. So yeah, I don't think, it's not that, I mean, that's an important thing to say actually here. The kind of prayer that he's talking about is not really like having a quiet time kind of prayer or something like that, because, not that there's anything wrong with having a quiet time, but that's not the sort of thing that he's talking about. The alternative is to despair. I come to that point where either I am going to go back to God or I'm going to walk away from him. I think that's the kind of thing we're looking at.
But it says at all times.
Right.
And it also says they cry out for day and night.
Right.
It seems like it's saying, I mean, at all times, regardless of circumstances, good or bad or whatever, it seems a pretty big statement. Not when things go bad and you seem to be despairing, you pray and don't lose heart. It's at all times.
Well, why? I mean, you're saying they cry out to him day and night. Am I to picture that, when I hear that, his elect crying out to him day and night, the picture I get is not of people who have said, let's get sure and together and make sure that there's every moment of the day where somebody is crying out to God. Will you take the 1 o'clock watch and you cry out to him then? I mean, the idea is they're crying out to him day and night because there's always injustice. There's always somebody calling out to God because things are always bad. So that one, day and night, I don't think, that doesn't imply you need to be constantly praying. They're crying out day and night because they are compelled to. Then for the other one, at all times, the question is, what does he mean by at all times? And when it is put in opposition to pray at all times and not lose heart, and the story of the widow in the picture that we have is a widow who faces the choice of whether she's going to go back again or whether she's going to give up, I think it makes a lot more sense to see at all times as being not just for a while and then give up when the answer is no, but always. Always, not in the sense of every moment, but always in the sense of without ever giving up. So, yeah, I think in the context tells us the kind of always that he has in mind. Yes, sir.
This is sort of subtle, but why do you think that in the end the widow gets justice? It would seem that it would put more emphasis on his point between our sufferings in this world and divine and ultimate justice if she was refused every time. I mean, she does get justice in the end, albeit from an unjust judge. And so why, I mean, is that to prove the... Is he trying to affirm the objective existence of justice? I mean, what is he doing by giving her justice?
Well, my understanding at this point... See, that. Remember that part that I said I was kind of sweeping under the rug? There are some complications to this part of it, but one way to understand it would be that the comparison is being made, kind of the emphasis, hear what the unrighteous judge said. Now will not God bring about justice. In the story, she gets it. As I'm understanding it, it is her getting the justice is a vindication of the wisdom of her continuing to go back. That she should have kept going back because she might get it, and that she did, in fact. And then the contrast is being made with God, with whom there is no question as to whether he's committed to justice. There shouldn't be any question in our mind, if we understand God, that he is going to bring about justice. The question is whether we're going to believe that he is going to bring about justice or not. So that's how I'm understanding that.
So he's not necessarily wanting to set up a juxtaposition of justice in the world versus eternal justice?
No, I don't think so. Typically, in his parables, he will use worldly things like pearls and inheritances and all of that kind of stuff, just as a commonsensical sort of analogy to something valuable or, you know, something like that. And I think it's just the worldly justice that he's asking for is, that she's asking for, is analogous to the deeper sort of justice that God's people are calling to him for. Okay, you and then you.
I think maybe it's just to show that God can bring about justice even through an unjust judge. Just to show that he has the power to do that.
Okay. Yes, he does. I don't have any problem with the theology of that. He certainly does have the power to do that. The thing I want you to think about here, though, is in these parables, we have a story where something happens and then an analogy is being made. So, I mean, we have stories like, here's a guy who has a pearl business, and he comes across a pearl that's so valuable that he sells everything he's got and buys the pearl. Or we have a story about a guy who, he's a servant, he's messed up, and he's going to be fired. But before he gets fired, he decides that he's going to use his position while he still has it to make some friends for himself so that he can get a job when he gets out. In each of these cases, the story sometimes... The story is supposed to stand kind of there on its own to say, see what happened here? The point that God can bring about justice through someone like that judge is true enough, but it's not really, that's not the point that Luke kind of emphasizes that Jesus is making in the story. And it's not as if we can say that we know that God will always do that, because sometimes evil judges never give justice to anyone, and the people that they call, that go to them, die never having gotten justice. So yes, God can do that, but I would say that what Jesus wants us to be looking at in the story is, think about that widow. You're in her situation. You are crying out for something, for justice, to a judge too. She kept going. What should you do? That's how I would put that together. So, like I say, I don't have any problem with the theology of that. In fact, that's good theology. I like that a lot. But, okay, you were...
Yeah, the Old Testament seems to have a lot of the same theme. Is this kind of the area where some of the Jews got the idea that Christ would be this great king that would come and wipe out all the bad evil?
Right. Yes. See, the Jews of the time did mistakenly have the notion that when the Messiah came, he was going to, like, get rid of the Romans and, you know, establish Israel as the center of the world and all of that kind of stuff. The thing is that they were not wrong to think so, because that is what's going to happen. I mean, Jesus ultimately is going to be king of the world and is going to eliminate, in the kingdom of God, the Romans are not going to cause anybody any trouble, or the Russians or the Americans or anybody else. So, but you're right, they were mistaken, because they had taken the political implications of that, you know, and saw that as the only real important thing that God had said. You know, great, we're going to get the Romans out. And they had lost sight of the promises like God writing his law in their hearts and, you know, atonement for sin and some of the deep things that the Old Testament talked about that were not as interesting. So, yeah.
So, and that's kind of what they were getting at when they were shouting Hosanna when he was going down.
Yes. Hey, this is great. And probably, I don't know, it's a little hard to say. The New Testament doesn't tell us a lot about what people were thinking. But it does seem reasonable to think that the people who were shouting Hosanna who not too many days later were crying out, "Crucify him," when Pilate was trying to find a way to let him off, probably were disappointed in him. As you know, they cried, "Hosanna, he's riding in, this must be it." And then when it became very clear that this wasn't it, I mean, he didn't seem to have any intention of kicking the Romans out and making himself king and that stuff, that they decided that maybe he wasn't the guy after all. Yeah, but this, the theme that God is going to restore creation and establish justice and rule through the Messiah to establish, to make right everything that's wrong with the world, that is a very biblical idea, very strong theme in the Old Testament. And he is repeating that here, I think. I mean, we can see similar kinds of ideas in the Old Testament as well as in Revelation and in other things too.
I know this parable seems to be about justice, but I was wondering about the Old Testament. First, talks about tossing away and tossing away the
ocean.
And I just was wondering where that fits in with all of this.
Right, right. Well, yes. Denise was asking about, she's saying, clearly this passage is talking about justice, but when we have a passage like, cast all your cares upon him because he cares for you, something like that, she's asking, how does that relate to what we're looking at here? I think there's kind of a, as I would put it together, there's sort of a rich kind of relationship. You have to look at a lot of different things to put it together. Because what I have is a picture of a God who cares about me not someday in the future, but now, who is committed to me now, who has promised that that ultimately life and fulfillment is to be found at its fullness in the future, in the kingdom of God, but at the same time is at work in my life now. But I also see, think about, I was talking about this the other day, think about Paul and his thorn in the flesh. Some affliction, we don't know what it was, but something that was a difficulty in his life, he calls it a thorn in the flesh. Paul, who very much believes that you should cast all your cares upon God because he cares for you, Paul himself says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything, with prayer and supplication, make your requests known to God. I mean, so Paul goes to God with the concerns. He has this difficulty in his life, and God's answer is no. I mean, he seems to pretty clearly understood God to be saying, no, I'm not going to take this away. Well, I have God's ultimate promises for my final redemption and well-being, and God's promises that now he is with me and he cares for me, but this is a time of the testing of my faith and a time of growing in wisdom, a time of learning through suffering, and I mean, there are many other things too, but that's a part of where I am now. What I would say is anything that I might be looking to for God, from God, justice, life, fulfillment, deliverance from sin, deliverance from the suffering that comes in a world like this, all of it is like that justice in this story, in that all of it I will cry out to God about. And all of it, he is going to be concerned and looking out for my life now, but in his wisdom, with all of it, there are ways in which ultimately it's not going to be fulfilled now. I am I am looking for the ultimate fulfillment to all of it in his promises in the future. Not that nothing is happening now. I'm not saying that God doesn't say yes to our requests sometimes, because he does. And I'm not saying that he does not deliver us from difficulties sometimes, because he does. But I'm also saying that sometimes he doesn't. And I think we can pretty much count on the fact that there's just no guarantee that God is going to do what I want him to do in any particular situation. But if I picture myself as on a journey toward the fulfillment of every desire that I have as a human being, for meaning and purpose, for love, for honor, for health, for fulfillment, I mean, everything that is a part of my makeup as a human being that I long for, ultimately God is saying is to be found in the fulfillment that he has when he establishes his kingdom. We're getting down payments on it now in various ways, but the ultimate fulfillment of it is here. So that's my long-winded way of saying that this parable applies to all of those things, in the sense that I cry out to God for whatever things are on my mind. I'm trusting him, looking to him to do right by me, but there are going to be those times when I have to hang in there with him because it's not going the way I want it to go. And to remember that ultimately he is going to do what he has promised to do, which involves ultimately everything that I want, everything that I'm looking for in the right sense. I don't mean, you understand what I mean. I mean, the real needs that are back behind all of my desires as a human being are going to be fulfilled in what God is bringing about. So in that sense, although in this case he's talking about justice, I think it really does apply to almost anything. Yeah.
Could you apply that to growing in trust and diminishing of pride?
In what way? What are you thinking?
If the first thing, my favorite prayer, is that I want to grow in trust of God and his character.
Okay. And okay, so I'm praying for that.
Right,
okay.
And I'm praying for diminishing of human pride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, right. Well, yeah, I think so, because I am looking, when it comes to my character altogether, I mean, pride and just anything having to do with my flesh and my struggles in this life, I can say, I mean, just speaking personally, that when I was younger, most of the stuff that I wanted and prayed about and concerned myself with had to do with the way I wanted things to go in this world, what I wanted to have or what I wanted to accomplish or the career I wanted to have or something like that. At this point in my life, at the ripe old age of 27, 47, almost all of my prayers have to do with my character, have to do with God, give me patience, give me strength, help me overcome my selfishness, my pride, my lust, my whatever. So, and there too, God is working with me. It's not that nothing is happening. I'm not the person that I used to be in many significant ways, but in many significant ways I am the person that I used to be, and I am looking to his promise in the kingdom of God. So in that sense, the same thing that he's saying here, he will not delay. He is going to answer this prayer. I am going to be delivered from myself. But I have to be patient. I have to keep going back, because, or I could give up. And actually, I think dealing with our own character can be a real trial of our faith. It may seem like a strange thing to say, but I'm just, in my experience with myself and with many Christians that I've dealt with over the years, there can come that spot where some great moral failure comes into your life and your response is to hate God because of it. Why would God let me do something like that? Why hasn't God fixed me yet? Or something like that. I mean, the sort of the injustice of, you know, turning around and shaking your fist at God because of what you did. But that can happen. It can be a real trial to come back to God there and say, you know, in spite of what I see that I am capable of doing, nonetheless, I still believe your promise that you are going to deliver me, and so I'm back again. So yeah, I think very much so. Well, we're at the end of the time. Were there any other questions that people wanted to ask?